The Church of God the Eternal presents the 27th message in a series by Mr. John Brisby, entitled A Survey of the Books of Samuel, given in Eugene, Oregon, May 9th, 2026.
We're going to continue right along in this survey of the books of Samuel. This will be the 27th message in the series, but we're going to be covering chapter 26, because if you will recall in the last installment, I took a detour to do an entire message on this topic of Old Testament polygamy. The fact that in chapter 25 of 1 Samuel, we covered at the very end of it, the fact that the happy news at the end of that chapter was David got himself two new wives, and so we needed to address this because obviously, and David's going to get even more wives and concubines. And as a king, he did a lot of the same things that a lot of kings in the world do. And so he had what we read it listed 19 sons and one daughter plus extra children along the way. So it was important for us to address this issue of Old Testament polygamy, how God views it, how it applies to you and me, and what our explanation. So I did all that, won't belabor it anymore. We're going to continue on now with the storyline in 1 Samuel chapter 26. So we'll begin in verse 1. And this sounds a lot like a repeat of what we had in chapter 23. I think you're going to find that. Verse 1 of chapter 26 says, And the Ziphites came unto Saul of Gibeah, saying, Doth not David hide himself in the hill of Hachilah, which is before Jeshimon? And that's exactly the wording, almost verbatim, that they used in chapter 23. The first time they went to Saul and say, Hey, David's hiding in our territory. We'll help you get him. So now it's happening again. History repeats itself. Recall from that chapter 23 that Ziph is a town or a region in the Judean highlands, 4 to 5 miles southeast of Hebron. It sits in rugged wilderness region, ideal for hiding, the wilderness of Ziph. The hills, the strongholds, and the areas in that area. Nearby towns mentioned in the very same region from Joshua 15 and other places include Maon, Carmel, which you'll remember was exactly the region where Nabal lived and had his empire, if you will, of animals that made him a wealthy man. So this is the very same region that David and his men have been haunting, if you will, in and around this area of southern Judah in the wilderness. And now the Ziphites, once again, now if you recall, their first attempt to help Saul capture David failed. They had him cornered. Remember that? Two parts of his army wrapping around this mountain. And David was right in the grasp until Saul got the message that the Philistines had attacked in the northwest. And that totally changed his priority. He took his army and he left and went chasing the Philistines. Okay, he's come back already. We already did this in chapter 24. He came back again to try and find David. So this is, if you want to say, the third time, the second time in this particular region. So here, believe it or not, there is a psalm dedicated to this period of time, Psalm 54. It's a short psalm. Let's read it together. It actually says it's a psalm of David. When the Ziphims came and said to Saul, Doth not David hide himself with us? So David intentionally wrote a psalm, the topic of which is his distress during the time that these men of Judah, and that's what these Ziphites are. They're actually his kinsmen. Not on his direct family, but they're all of the same tribe of Judah. And yet here these people are trying to sell David out to the king to gain some favor or enrich themselves with the king. And so here is how David actually put it into music with the word to the lyrics of this psalm. Save me, O God, by thy name, and judge me by thy strength. It reminds me of our hymn that we have taken from this very psalm. Hear my prayer, O God, give ear to the word of my mouth. Verse 3, for strangers are risen up against me. What strangers? They're all Israelites that are his enemies, that have made themselves his enemies, that are chasing him, trying to kill him. King Saul and these particular men of Judah, and yet they're behaving like strangers. And that's how David sees them. For strangers are risen up against me, and oppressors seek after my soul. They have not set God before them. So this is David's assessment of the motivation of the people involved in this conflict. And what he's saying is, they are not following God's will at all. I'm being victimized by these godless individuals who have ill intent for me. Selah, verse 4, behold, God is my helper. As a direct contrast to whoever's helping his enemies, the Lord is with them that uphold my soul. Now, that can either be an arrogant statement or else it's true. If it's true that God supports David, then it's also true, and it makes perfect sense to say that God supports and will bless anyone who helps David and is against, by contrast, anyone who was against David. He's just stating a fact. So it's not an arrogance. It could be arrogance if that was the place from which he was thinking or coming, but it's not. He's just telling the truth as it is. But it points out the fact that you and I need to be careful too. You know, in not backing the wrong horse, let's say, in given times, and making sure that we're putting ourselves against God, if God is actually backing a certain course of action or in a certain realm. And sooner or later, we all run into those same kind of challenges and know the difference. Verse 5, he shall reward evil unto my enemies. Cut them off in thy truth. So David is acknowledging that he's serving the God of truth. And anybody who is against David, seeking to kill David, is against God and his truth. He's putting them all in one camp or the other. Verse 6, he says, I will freely sacrifice unto thee. I will praise thy name, O eternal, for it is good. Again, remember, I've already pointed out to you a number of times the fact that even in the midst of great trial, where David is running for his life in great distress under these impending circumstances, and yet he takes the time to praise God and to thank him for all the blessings that God has given to him in spite of his trials day by day. And here he does it again. He shall reward evil unto mine enemies, cut them off in thy truth. I will freely sacrifice unto thee. I will praise thy name, O eternal, for it is good. And then verse 7, for he hath delivered me out of all trouble, and mine eye hath seen his desire upon mine enemies. So he's focusing on the fact God has already proved himself to me many times. So even though he's facing another threat, he's hearkening back to all of the times that God has already come to his defense and saved him and spared him. And he's manifesting that confidence, that faith, that God is going to continue to do the same. Okay, back to 1 Samuel chapter 26, and now verse 2. So the Ziphites go to Saul and say, hey, we know where he is again. Verse 2, then Saul arose and went down to the wilderness of Ziph. Back in chapter 23, he didn't go immediately. He said, well, you go and do some more reconnaissance and get me some more details about exactly where it is, and then maybe I'll come with an army. This time, the Ziphites go, they say, we know where he's at, and Saul jumps on the opportunity. Saul arose and went down to the wilderness of Ziph, having 3,000 chosen men of Israel with him to seek David in the wilderness of Ziph, just like he did once before. And he was almost successful, so I can see in the mind of Saul it would make sense to try it again. I mean, the only thing that stopped him from getting David the first time was the Philistines. That was just bad timing. So now, here's the chance now to finally conquer his foe. And Saul pitched in the hill of Hachilah, which is before Jeshimon, by the way. But David abode in the wilderness, and he saw that Saul came after him into the wilderness, meaning Saul and his army did not catch David off guard. David had the intelligence network. We're going to find out here in verse 4. David had a very good network of spies. He was clued in this time. He did not get caught off guard, probably like he did the first time whatsoever, which means he was ready and prepared. And remember now, he's already been wandering around in these desert wildernesses now for several years. So he's becoming probably very good at this. His men now have been under his charge, the 600 men, for quite a number of years. They are becoming more professional, if you will, in their ability to make their way and to handle themselves in these environments. So verse 4, David therefore sent out spies and understood that Saul was come in very deed, which is awkward old English from the King James. In our modern parlance, we would say Saul had indeed come. So he sent out spies to verify, yep, it's absolutely true. They were able to put eyes on Saul and his army, so they knew exactly what he intended to do and where he was going. Verse 5, and David arose and came to the place where Saul had pitched. So his army stops for the night. They pitch their tents, and David's right there watching them. And David beheld the place where Saul lay. And I'm presuming that this is in a high place in hills around some kind of a valley or a low place where the army was. We'll actually see that. I think I can prove that to you when we get down to verse 13. It doesn't talk about hilly terrain at this point, but you're going to see that in the storyline that it's absolutely true. So I envision, right or wrong, that Saul and his army are now setting up camp for the night in this valley, and David and his men are along the ridge line looking down on them. And Abner, the son of Ner, the captain of his host, so he's got his premier general, Abner, and I'll make a couple of comments on him in a moment, and Saul lay in the trench, and the people pitched around about him. Now, this trench for you and me would throw us off, because that gives me, you know, the idea that Saul is pitching his tent in a gully, you know, some crevasse or some place where the water washes or something. That is not it at all. This is actually a poor translation. It's a word in the Hebrew that actually means either circle, circuit, or encampment perimeter. So it's not a trench at all in the way you and I are talking about. It actually refers to the center of a circular camp that the army had formed in the night, meaning it's a defensive camp setup with Saul and his most trusted men in the center for defensive purposes. All right? So that's really what is going on here. Who is Abner? You will recall Abner happens to be the cousin, the first cousin of King Saul, because Abner's father, Ner, is the brother of Kish, who is Saul's father. So literally, first cousins through their fathers. And Abner has got a bigger role even as we go forward. He's already been fairly prominent. He is the chief military officer under the king. Besides Saul having his own history from a young man as being a warrior and a general, and yet he's got Abner here, and when you take on the responsibilities of the king, that is greatly enhanced if you've got military men that you can trust, and Abner is the guy. He's fearless, he's shrewd, and he is the one that helps Saul in very many ways to accomplish all that he does militarily. So Abner is a key character in this storyline, even highly respected by David. And I only point that out because as we get into this further, you're going to see events that unfold at the end of Saul's reign, the rise of David when he first becomes king over the southern portion of the kingdom in Judah. After Saul dies, Abner takes on a premier role to try and fill the void. He's not on the right side of things because he's not following what God wants, but Abner is certainly a very key individual in the storyline. So here is Abner, this premier military leader under Saul. He is with his best fighting men are camped around Saul for protection purposes for the night. Verse 6, David now is going to make a reckless, I'm going to call it a reckless foray into Saul's camp. at night. Verse 6, then answered David and said to Ahimelech the Hittite and to Abishai, the son of Zeruiah, brother to Joab, saying, who will go down with me to Saul to camp? And Abishai said, I will go down with thee. Okay, let's unpack that a little bit. First, who is this Ahimelech the Hittite? Only place that he is even referenced. This is not Ahimelech the high priest who was murdered previously in the storyline with 85 priests, all right? This is not the same Ahimelech. It's a different man. This one is a Hittite, not an Israelite. And who were the Hittites? Remember, the Hittites were one faction of the old Canaanites, all right, of the land, who had been in the promised land for a very long time. Now, why, if he is a pagan Hittite, is he with David? Well, I'm not going to go through all of that, but just remember, the laws of God did permit non-Israelites who would become circumcised and would embrace the God of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob to actually take part in the nation. Now, they could never be inheritors of the land, but if they chose to make the one true God their God, they were given a place in the nation. They showed respect. All right. So obviously, this Ahimelech is one such who chose to make his life with the Israelites. To whatever extent any of them were really following, you know, suit with obedience to God, and it's always a hit and miss thing through all eras of time. But he was obviously, because he was one of the trusted chosen men of David, he must have been one of those fearless warriors that David trusted. Who's the other one now? Abishai, the son of Zeruiah, brother to Joab. Well, who was that? Abishai was one of the three sons of Zeruiah. Who is this? It's not a man. It's a woman. This is actually his mother. So it's not common in the Bible where you actually see individuals identify as the son of their mother. It's usually the father, the son of, you know, this important man or whatever else. This is a case, but in given times in the Bible, God points out the significance of a particular woman. And this is one then where these sons were actually known as sons of their mother. Now, it could be for no other reason than the fact that his mother was the sister of David. And maybe that's what it is. If you turn with me to 1 Chronicles 2, 15 and 16, we find the actual genealogy here. This is David's genealogy of their father, Jesse. And I'm just picking out the end of verse 15 here, Ozam the sixth, David the seventh. I'm not going through the whole list of all seven sons. David was the youngest, the seventh son of Jesse. But then it wasn't just sons. Verse 16, whose sisters were Zeruiah and Abigail. So interestingly, David had a younger sister named Abigail, not to be confused with the one he married, his wife Abigail, the former wife of Nabal. And the sons of Zeruiah, Abishai, so he was the oldest, and Joab, and Asahel, three. So these are three sons who are therefore David's nephews. Okay, so this becomes important in the storyline to understand that these men are fiercely devoted to David. And there's a family connection regardless of politics. But that helps many times. And so here's the case where his nephews, not only are they loyal by blood, but they are also very fearsome warriors. All right. So these three are like a two-edged sword. Because for all of the devotion and the strength and the power and the fearlessness that they bring, they also gave David a lot of grief when they actually went too far in a number of cases. They often created problems with their hot-tempered, bloodthirsty tendencies. And greatest among them was the middle son, Joab. So we're talking about Abishai right now, but his younger brother, Joab, is going to be the one that's going to be key in the chapters that follow. Joab is going to be to David like Abner is to Saul, meaning his chief military general. who basically controls and directs David's army. That's the role that Joab is going to fill. So this family is very, very key. And Joab, for all of his zeal and trying to support and further David's causes, is also going to make some very bad choices. Going to get himself into trouble. Because he doesn't have the same thinking as David. And again, that's pointing us back to what I believe is one of the key stories in the entire life of David. The difference in the way David viewed things and made decisions compared to the way most other people would. And I think Joab and his brothers are the classic example of zeal without wisdom. They're willing to go in and do anything. Just tell me what to do. Fearlessly go in with great courage, but not all the time with wisdom. And so we'll see that as the storyline unfolds. But in this case, David says, who wants to go with me down into Saul's camp? And I'm presuming it doesn't say day or night, but I'm assuming they're sleeping, so I'm assuming it's in the middle of the night. Why is he going to do that? Now, it doesn't say that Ahimelech volunteered, but Abishai sure did. He said, I'll go. And so verse 7, so David and Abishai came to the people by night. And behold, Saul lay sleeping within the trench, or better, the defensive circle that was set up by the camp. And his spear stuck in the ground at his bolster, but Abner and the people lay around about him. So they're all asleep. I want to know, where are the sentries? Aren't they supposed to have 24/7 sentries on duty when you've got a 3,000-man army out in a wilderness chasing an enemy who's got 600 soldiers under him? And yet, there's never a mention of any sentries on duty. Is that what David saw from up on a hill line? It's like, they're all asleep and we don't see any sentries. Let's go down in their camp. But that's what they did. He and this fearless supporter, his nephew Abishai. All right, what else did we read here? His spear, so Saul's laying there asleep in this defensive circle, his spear stuck in the ground at his bolster. What's a bolster? And I looked all this up, okay, the Hebrew and what does it mean and all this. Now, how do we use it? I bet the ladies probably know what a bolster is. I didn't know, and I had a vague recollection once I read it. A bolster is like a pillow. Do any of you have any? We actually have a bolster on our bed. It's like this large sausage-looking pillow along the other pillows on the bed. My wife asked me, I told her, there's going to be a bolster in the sermon today. She said, are you going to talk about our pillows on our bed? And I said, no. So I'm not. I'm innocent. But that's what we call a bolster. Where did we get it? Probably, literally from individuals camping, military personnel, whatever, just rolling up a cloak into a roll that you put your head on, creating a pillow out of something. That's probably the origin of it. That is one of the possibilities the scholars say perhaps is what Saul is doing. He may have literally been resting with his head on a bolster, this pillow made of a rolled up cloak or something else. Or sometimes they refer to it as something next to his head. But in any case, it says his spear is stuck in the ground at his bolster, or right next to, probably, the pillow that he's sleeping on. So now we're going to find, and Abner is there. Abner's asleep too. All these best warriors of Saul under Abner are all sleeping in the middle of the center of the camp. So David and Abishai literally would have had to wind their way through to get to the middle where Saul is. Not out on the fringe. Right in the middle. And now Abishai sees the opportunity. It's like, whoa, Saul is in our power. We can get rid of him right here. Verse 8. Then said Abishai to David, God hath delivered thine enemy into thine hand this day. Isn't it the way human beings interpret? Abishai wanted to kill Saul. Saul was the reason for all of their problems. Not just from David's point of view, but think about Abishai and all these 600 men who've been following David now for several years in the wilderness. And why are they outcast in their own country? Because King Saul's trying to kill them. So they all had a vested interest in taking this opportunity and killing him. But now Abishai already knows, because David's already proved several times about his weakness, quote unquote, for Saul. Like, why he won't just take out his enemy, I don't know why anybody else would. And so Abishai's, in essence, trying to reason with David to get David to let him kill Saul. God hath delivered thine enemy into thine hand this day. Now, therefore, he's pleading to David, let me smite him, I pray thee, with the spear, even to the earth at once, and I will not smite him the second time. What's he saying? He says, David, I promise I'll make it a quick kill. Saul will not suffer. He will not even know. I'll strike him one time and he will die instantly. As if that would make a difference to David, or hoping it would make a difference to David, and David would go, well, okay. But Abishai still didn't understand, as much as David had already demonstrated many, many times, his respect for the office of the king of Israel, regardless of the personality or the character of the man in that office at the time. David, past and present, still views him as the anointed of the Lord, which he was. And he was not going to take advantage of it. But boy, it had to be tempting. They've just walked into the middle of the enemy camp, right into the heart of it, and they're all fast asleep. There's his spear. They could kill him with his own spear. Verse 9, and David said to Abishai, destroy him not. For who can stretch forth his hand against the Eternal's anointed and be guiltless? This is not an issue about expediency for human beings. This is about recognizing the authority of God. Invisible though he may be, he is real, and we are accountable to him. And so David does not forget it. This is phenomenal. I mean, we can just read it. Oh, yeah, yeah, yeah. This is the key, in my mind, to the entire books of Samuel. This kind of decision-making of David under pressure to show the respect for God and his authority as it's manifested on the earth through the priest and through the king. Instead of taking the easy way out and justifying it, which he could have easily done, he bypasses again the opportunity to take out his enemy. And keep this in mind. David has already been anointed by Samuel to be the king of Israel. He already knows God has appointed him to become king of Israel back when he was a teenager. Now he's up 26, 27, 28 years old. He's still not king. And the current king on the throne is trying to kill him relentlessly. David could not become the king until Saul died. So think about it from his standpoint. Well, the other alternative would be that Saul abdicates the throne and says, no, I know God is not pleased with me. I'm going to leave the throne and go into retirement and let David become the king. Yeah, fat chance. That's not going to happen. And David doesn't even entertain it. He knows the only way for God's will to be fulfilled, for David to become king over Israel, is for Saul to die. And here's Saul right in his hands. He could help God. He could help God by killing him, or let Abishai kill him with one stroke. And then God's will would be fulfilled and he would become king. Isn't that the way most of us would think? Well, maybe not you. It's the way I would think. Let's help God. Let's fulfill God's will. You see, this is why David's thinking and his orientation and his decision-making, even under pressure, is so significant. It is one of the key reasons that God, at the end of his life, called him a man after God's own heart. It's for these kind of decisions. David, verse 10, said furthermore, not just this, Saul is not just a man, he is the anointed of God. Who can be guiltless and disrespect and kill this man? Verse 10, David said furthermore. Now, I want to know, how are they talking? Where are they? Are they literally standing there in the middle of the camp having this conversation? Or was this outside the camp? I don't know. We get a little bit of help with the answer momentarily. But I'm like, here they are sneaking into the camp, and then Abishai and David are having this conversation. Let's do this. And David's saying, no, blah, 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 blah. Anyway, question unanswered. David said, furthermore, as the eternal liveth, the eternal shall smite him. So again, David knows Saul has to die. There's no way the prophecy concerning him becoming king can happen until Saul is dead. So David wants Saul to die, but he's not going to take matters into his own hand to do it. But I think this is interesting. David said, furthermore, as the eternal liveth, the Lord shall smite him. Oh, God is going to take Saul out. Or the Lord shall smite him. That's actually a number one way that Saul might die. Or number two, his day shall come to die. Or number three, he shall descend into battle and perish. David just listed three different ways that Saul might die, opening the way for him to become king. Verse 11, the eternal forbid that I should stretch forth my hand against the eternal's anointed. He said, I will not be the one to force the issue in disrespect to God. So David allowed for three possible ways Saul might die. As I said, number one, God strikes him down dramatically, like a lightning bolt out of heaven, you know, whatever. Number two, he dies of natural causes. Or else number three, he dies violently at the hand of man, like in a battle, without a seeming miracle from God involved. And in fact, that third one is what's going to happen. Now, God was involved because he did not protect Saul or Jonathan. We'll get to that story within a couple of chapters. Okay, but at this point, David is musing about the possible ways that God will take Saul out, but he says it won't be by my hand. Either God will strike him down, he'll die of natural causes, or else he'll die at the hand of man, not directed by God. Those are the three options David could see. But, continuing the end of verse 11, but I pray thee, take thou now the spear that is at his bolster and the cruse of water, and let us go. So David was not beyond making his presence known or engaging in a political stunt. Well, the very fact he chose, why did he want to go down into the camp in the middle of the night anyway? So in essence, he had a mischievous mind or an orientation to do this. I suspect that David knew that God literally was backing him up, as we're going to find out here. So David wants Saul to know that once again, David had the chance to kill him and did not. He refrained. He's trying to make the point to Saul, I am not your enemy. Verse 12, so David took the spear and the cruse of water from Saul's bolster. This cruse is just a water flask. Scholars think most of them were made out of clay, either in a small pitcher that they used for travel or else literally something that was thinner in a flask type configuration. Whatever it was, he had his spear there next to his head and he had this water flask next to his head. David and Abishai take both of them with them and leave the camp. And they got them away, and no man saw it, nor knew it, neither awakened. How did they sneak into camp, having their little conversation back and forth, take the spear and the water flask of Saul and get out, and nobody knew it? And again, I ask the question, where were the sentries? For they were all asleep. Why? Because they were just dog tired after all those miles of trudging down from Gibeah. No. Because a deep sleep from the eternal was fallen upon them. Aha. You mean God intervened miraculously to put his thumb on the scale of these events? That's exactly what happened. So I bet you there were sentries that were assigned on duty. And I bet they could not overcome the slumber that God supernaturally put upon every single one of them. They were all asleep. In such a deep sleep, they didn't even remotely wake up during the time that David and Abishai came into their camp. Verse 13, then what happens? Now, is this still in the night? Is this after the sun rises? It doesn't tell. Verse 13, then David went over to the other side and stood on the top of a hill afar off. This is where I told you, this gives you an indication about the terrain. I suspect this is the same hill line in which he was spying on Saul and his men ahead of time when they first arrived. Maybe so, maybe not. David went over to the other side and stood on top of a hill afar off. Well, it says afar off, but as you're going to find out, there's conversation going on between David and Abner and Saul, which means they have to be in earshot. All right? A great space being between them. Verse 14, and David cried. Now, who is David addressing here? Pay attention. David cried to the people and to Abner, the son of Ner, Saul's general. So David is not choosing to address Saul directly. And this is where I think there's some really interesting nuances in this whole thing. David is being a political animal here. David cried to the people. The entire army of Saul is laid out before him. His whole army and his entourage, whoever he brought with him. David cried to the people and to Abner, Saul's general. And what did David say to the people and to Abner? Answerest thou not, Abner? He's speaking to Abner directly. Abner, do you answer? Then Abner answered and said, who art thou that cries to the king? He didn't know who this was. So was it still in the dark? Did he just not recognize David's voice? Whatever. I see it more like in the daytime. You write it the way you see it in your head. Doesn't matter. But Abner's like, who's yelling at us from the top of a nearby hill? Who are you and what do you want? Verse 15, and David said to Abner, and I add, in the presence of all of Saul's army, David says to Abner, art not thou a valiant man? Don't you have the pedigree of being the greatest military warrior and servant of Saul? Art thou not a valiant man? And who is like to thee in Israel? No one has a greater reputation for valor and for cunning in military arts. Wherefore, then, hast thou not kept thy lord the king? Why have you not protected your king? You're such a great man. You have such a history of a great reputation on the battlefield and in strategy. You're a counselor of the king, which he was. Why haven't you safeguarded your king? For there came one out of the people and to destroy the king, my lord. Now, David wasn't coming to destroy him. Do you think David's being a little sarcastic here? Oh, yeah. There came one of the people in to destroy the king, thy lord. There was an enemy in which you were supposed to be protecting your king against. And they came right in the middle of your camp while you were all sleeping. Verse 16, this thing is not good that thou hast done. He's saying to Abner, tisk, tisk, you're not a very good general. As the Lord lives, David says, you are worthy to die. In fact, you're not just negligent, Abner. Your negligence makes you worthy to die, which was the very common treatment that kings in the ancient world would have used to any sentry who failed to do their job. And that was the way that they would make sure that these men who were assigned to sentry duty stayed awake instead of falling asleep. They knew their lives were at jeopardy. This thing is not good that thou hast done. As the Lord lives, you are worthy to die because you have not kept your master, the Lord's anointed. So David is acknowledging that Saul, his master, is the Lord's anointed. That's interesting, isn't it? Yelling this from the top of the hillside. You're in charge of protecting God's anointed. You're this great, valiant military man of renown. And you fell down on the job, and you're worthy of death. And now David says, see where the king's spear is. Because up till now, none of them knew what had happened yet. They had not put two and two together. And so Abner could have replied and said, what are you talking about? We've been protecting the king the whole time. There's no way you could have got in here or done anything. You're just making all this up. David says, and now see where the king's spear is and the cruse of water that was at his bolster. Where's the king's spear and that jug of water that were next to his head while you all were sleeping? And I can imagine them looking around and, oops, it's missing. And then David's going to hold it up. Say, here they are. Verse 17, and Saul knew David's voice. So Abner didn't seem to recognize David's voice. Saul recognized the voice of David. Saul knew David's voice and said, is this thy voice, my son David? Either it's still dark or he's so far away you can't make out the detail, one of the two. And David said, it is my voice, my lord, O king. So now David turns his conversation away from Abner to the king. But it's still being done publicly in front of the entire army of Saul. This entire drama, this interchange is happening in front of thousands. It is my voice, my lord, O king. He begins by asserting his recognition of the authority of the office of Saul. He shows respect and deference to Saul as the king over Israel. And he said, David, still speaking, verse 18, wherefore doth my Lord thus pursue after his servant? For what have I done, or what evil is in my hand? David is now going to turn this public conversation into a trial. That's really what's happening here. Saul recognizes his voice. He says, is that you, David? And David says, yes, it's me, O Lord. Why are you chasing me? Respectfully, why are you chasing me? As if I am guilty of some evil against you. Wherefore does my Lord thus pursue after his servant? For what have I done? What evil is in my hand? What evidence is there that I have ever intended harm to you or have worked against you? Because that's why they were chasing him, trying to kill him. So David creates the spectacle, in essence, of a public trial for the purpose of proving his innocence before all. Now, how many of the army of Saul do you think had been affected by the propaganda coming from the king and his court? Oh, David's trying to undermine, you know, and he did all these nefarious things and accused him of all these illicit things that weren't true. And yet the men would believe it, which means they were motivated. Let's get the enemy of our king. We're defending our king against this enemy who seeks to overthrow him. So there were probably a whole lot of ones in that audience who had that in their mind. David's taking the opportunity to try and change hearts and minds. It's an absolute political gambit is what's going on here. Verse 19, David continues, now therefore, I pray thee, speaking to Saul, let my Lord the king hear the words of his servant. Lord king, let me please have my say. Give me an opportunity to testify on my own behalf before you as king and judge. If, David says, if the Eternal have stirred thee up against me, let him accept an offering. There's two possibilities here. In the first one, David says, he allows for the possibility that maybe David has showed disrespect to Saul, is a threat to the king, and maybe God is displeased with David. Maybe David's in this trouble because God is the one who's persecuting him through Saul. Interesting that David allows that and submits it for everyone to consider. If the Eternal has stirred you up against, if this is God using you as his instrument to chase me, maybe you are doing God's work. Maybe I'm an enemy of the nation. Maybe I deserve to be ridden down and killed. Maybe so. If the Eternal have stirred thee up against me, let him accept an offering. He says, if I'm guilty, I would like to repent. I would like to make an offering to God to acknowledge my guilt and to ask for forgiveness. That's why you would have an offering. But if that's not what's really going on, but if they be the children of men, if Saul, the reason you're chasing me and trying to kill me is because of other people who have whispered in your ear to cause you to be suspicious of me, to doubt me, if you have been told lies by people for their own political purposes, if that's what this is all about, cursed be they before the Eternal, for they have driven me out this day from abiding in the inheritance of the Eternal, saying, go serve other gods. What's that about? David saying, I'm a faithful Israelite, but I'm being hunted and pushed out of my own homeland. He feels cut off from the place where God's presence and people are centered. David is saying, by driving me out of Israel, you're forcing me into foreign lands where I would have no choice but to live among pagans and their false gods. He's not necessarily saying of course, I have no choice but to start bowing before false gods. He's just saying, I'm being, against my will, forced into these pagan strongholds where I'm just surrounded by their hedonism and their paganism. When he's saying, I haven't done anything to deserve it. Now, what do you not find in this soliloquy by David? One of the options for what's going on, he only gave two. Either God doesn't like what I'm doing and he's using you as his instrument to punish me, or else somebody else has whispered in your ear to make you doubt me, and that's why you're chasing me. Are either one of those true? Neither one of them is true. What's the truth? Why was Saul chasing David? Was it because somebody else poisoned in his mind David and his reputation is intense? It was Saul's own arrogance. We already went through all of that. When did it first manifest? When the ladies marched through this parade into town and sang that song, Saul has killed his thousands and David his 10,000s. And that was the moment where Saul turned. It didn't take anybody whispering into his ear telling him, David's out to get you, better watch out for him. He's looking for an opportunity to undermine your family and your throne and take over for himself. There was none of that. It was Saul. It was in Saul's mind. The problem came in the very mind of the king, inspired and augmented by the influence of demons. We've already seen that. This black cloud, this evil spirit, which you've already seen described. That's the way God chose to describe it, an evil spirit influencing him. Where were the human beings who were poisoning Saul against David? There were not. Oh, I'm sure there were a whole lot of ones. Once Saul demonstrated his paranoia and started becoming suspicious himself of David, who would be happy to pile on and say, oh yeah, I think you're right, Saul. I'd be worried about David too. But that's not where it started. The problem started in the mind of Saul. But isn't it interesting that David did not say that in public? Now, if he had just told the truth, he would have said, Saul, why are you persecuting me? You have no reason to be paranoid Why did you decide that I'm an enemy and seek to kill me? He did not say that. David is playing a political game here because he's doing it all in public. So the only two options he offers is either God led you to chase me for a holy purpose, or else some other bad person convinced you that I was bad, meaning you got bad counsel and you're chasing me for the wrong reason. Either way, David is saying, I'm innocent, Saul, but he's trying to give Saul a way out. He's trying to give Saul a means to save face and say, you're right, David. Somebody I shouldn't have trusted told me you're an enemy, but I see the truth now. So how cunning and how sly is David? Very. And you wouldn't necessarily get that if you just read through this, but I think it's highly significant. David shows humility. Here, verse 20, now therefore, David says, let not my blood fall to the earth before the face of the Eternal. For the king of Israel is come out to seek a flea, as when one doth hunt a partridge in the mountains. David saying, I'm not worth your time and your effort to chase. You've got more important things to do as king of Israel. He's saying to Saul, I promise you, King Saul, I am no threat to you. I am no more than a flea. I'm not even worthy of your time or your effort. He's saying, I should not be public enemy number one. Now we get to Saul's reply, verse 21. Then said Saul, I have sinned. This is a remarkable statement because it's not happening in private, it's happening in public. Before these 3,000 soldiers and the entire entourage of those who were there. Now, it doesn't say how many were there around David up on the hillside, but I'll bet you he had quite an entourage too. But here is King Saul in public before thousands saying, I have sinned. I think it's rather remarkable. I have sinned. Return, my son David. I'm the one at fault, he's saying to David. You should return. You should be welcomed back into the fold. For I will no more do thee harm, because my soul was precious in thine eyes this day. He's saying, David, you proved you have no ill will toward me, because you had an opportunity to kill me in the middle of the night while we were sleeping, and you didn't do it. You've demonstrated your character and your support and your respect for my office. I will no more do thee harm, because my soul was precious in your eyes this day. My life was important to you. You proved that. Therefore, your life is going to become precious to me. I'm going to stop trying to kill you. Behold, Saul says, I have played the fool. Besides saying he sinned, he calls himself acknowledged foolishness in the midst of thousands. I have played the fool and have erred exceedingly. And now remember this great distance between them. In order for this conversation to take place, they're talking at the top of their voices in order to be able to carry. Can you imagine being in that position, the top of your lungs before thousands saying, I have sinned. I have played the fool. So there's still a side to King Saul that demonstrates that original integrity that caused him to be such an effective servant of God from his youth, when he was first anointed by Samuel himself and then put upon the throne. It's still there. The problem is that part of the mind of Saul is being overcome by all of these other elements that are plaguing him. So it's an incredibly humbling statement made in public by the king. David now follows up with more theatrics. That's what I'm going to call it. Verse 22, and David answered and said, behold the king's spear. Here's proof I could have killed you. Here's your spear. Behold the king's spear, and let one of your young men come over and fetch it. And I'm not trying to hold on to it as a trophy, he's saying. Send one of your young men, your pages, up here, and I'll hand it to him so he can take your spear back to you. The eternal, David says, verse 23, the eternal render to every man his righteousness and his faithfulness. Here's another political statement coming, where David, rather than making an accusation directly at Saul, talks around it. The eternal render to every man his righteousness and his faithfulness. If somebody is righteous, if someone is faithful, God will bless him, isn't what he's saying. For the eternal delivered thee into my hand today, but I would not stretch forth mine hand against the eternal's anointed. In other words, he seconds what Saul has already said. Saul already said, David, you've proved yourself. You had an opportunity to kill me, and you didn't. You treasured my life. Therefore, I'm not going to keep chasing you anymore. And in essence, David punctuates that by saying, yeah, here's the proof of that. Here's your spear. I did have the chance to kill you, and I did not do it for reason. David is saying, you are trying to kill me, even though I've done nothing wrong, as we're going to see in verse 24. Behold, David says, as thy life was much set by this day in mine eyes, as I showed value in your life and protecting you, David says, so let my life be much set by in the eyes of you? No. I protected you, King Saul, so in return, I would like you to protect me. That's not what he says. He says, I showed my willingness to protect you. Therefore, let my life be much set by in the eyes of the eternal, and let him deliver me out of all tribulation. He is not showing any confidence whatsoever in Saul, his change of heart, his willingness to follow through and to show favor for David, but it's an absolutely masterful political statement. He does not accuse Saul, but at the same time, he demonstrates a roundabout way. Yes, I've showed my intention, my righteousness, if you will, to have the right things in mind to respect God and you as king over Israel. In response to that, I'm depending upon God to be the one to take care of me, no man. He wasn't begging for Saul's approval. He says, I will get my sustenance and my help and my defense from God. New International Version says here, as surely as I value your life today, so may the eternal value my life and deliver me from all trouble. David is not depending upon Saul for his favor. He will rely upon God to save him. So, a very interesting reply indeed. Verse 25, this one's key. Then Saul said to David in reply, blessed be thou, my son David. Thou shalt both do great things and also shalt still prevail. I'm going to stop right there. What is happening here? Out of the mouth of King Saul is coming a prophecy. Does it remind you of anything? Saul accurately is foretelling David's future. He's saying, in essence, you will do great things and you will surely triumph. That's what this word prevail means. David, you do have a bright future. You will do great things and you will triumph. It aligns perfectly with God's earlier promises made to David through Samuel's anointing in 1 Samuel chapter 16, and later the words of Jonathan, Saul's son, his best friend, in 1 Samuel 23:17. So those are just examples of a confirmation of human beings that David is the one that God has picked to ascend to that throne and to lead. And now it's coming from David's enemy in the form of Saul, who brought 3,000 men into the wilderness to find him to try to kill him. And fast forward, now Saul is saying, you will do great things and you will triumph. What an amazing turnabout. And David did indeed do great things. He became king. God established a dynasty through him, including our Savior Jesus Christ. Under David, the territory of Israel was expanded with his success against Israel's enemies. He became the greatest human king in Israel's history. Some can argue his son Solomon because of all the great things. But everything Solomon achieved was because of what his father accomplished in God's service, which is what makes this story in the books of Samuel so key. Commentaries often note that Saul is, quote unquote, among the prophets. Again here, echoing earlier times when the Spirit came upon Saul, like in 1 Samuel 10, if you'll remember, and 1 Samuel 19. Remember where he started prophesying because God inspired him through the Holy Spirit all of a sudden to speak. And they said, is Saul among the prophets? He's acting like one of the religious gurus in our nation. Not the supposed king. And here is a glimmer of the old Saul. Once again, after years, prophesying by God's inspiration about what the future is going to hold concerning David. Even in his compromised spiritual state, God can use someone's word to declare the truth. We're getting close to the end here. Let's turn to John 11, verse 49. Is there another example in the Bible where this same kind of thing happened? Do you think Saul is close to God? Do you think Saul has God's favor? Not at all. He has made himself the enemy of God, which is why God took away his favor from Saul through the proclamation of Samuel. And Saul's been suffering ever since, has been plagued by evil spirits. So Saul is not close to God at all. Well, then how is Saul going to speak the truth of God in a prophecy when he's not a righteous man at all and is not close to God whatsoever? Can God do that? Oh, yeah. John 11, verse 49, fast forward to the days of Jesus Christ. One of them, now here's this cabal of Jewish leaders, including the high priest of the day, Caiaphas, are all in council trying to figure out how they're going to kill Jesus. One of them, named Caiaphas, being the high priest, that same year said unto them, you know nothing at all, verse 50, nor consider that it is expedient for us that one man should die for the people and that the whole nation perish not. Now, Caiaphas thought he was bolstering his comrades to follow through on this plan to kill Jesus. But God was actually inspiring the words out of the mouth of Caiaphas to pronounce a prophecy of the future. Verse 51, and this spake he not of himself, here's confirmation, but being high priest that year, which he was in the office, although he was a despicable character, he held a godly office as high priest. This he spake not of himself, but being high priest that year, he prophesied that Jesus should die for that nation. And not for that nation only, but that also he should gather together in one the children of God that were scattered abroad. Here, an evil man with evil intent trying to kill Jesus actually prophesied God's intent to make Jesus the Savior of the world through his death and his resurrection to become king, who happened to be a descendant of David, the one that we're talking about. In the very same way that the enemies of Jesus were trying to kill him, and they did, and yet the forefather, David, was under the same kind of threat by Saul and those who saw David as a thorn in their side and wanted to get rid of him in the name of God. So can history repeat itself? Oh, yeah. Has it in these storylines? You better believe it has. And furthermore, then, can God actually use a despicable, hateful individual to proclaim a prophecy that fulfills his will? Oh, yes, and that's exactly what Saul did. Back to 1 Samuel 26, the very last part of the last verse, verse 25. What happened? So Saul says, David, you're going to do great things. You're going to triumph. I'm not going to harm you anymore. You have convinced me. You're not against me. You are welcome back. And David said, great. Let's all go back to Gibeah together. Nope, didn't happen. Just like it didn't happen the first time when Saul had this repentant attitude and said, "You're right, David, you've never been a threat to me. I was wrong. I'm going to quit." And David doesn't trust him now either, and good for him, because Saul is not even in control of his own mind. He's a weak-minded individual who is subject to all of these emotions and this influence by these evil spirits. So what did David do? It's like, okay, show your respect, part ways. Instead of chasing him anymore, Saul took his 3,000 soldiers and entourage and went back home. What did David do? So David went on his way, and Saul returned to his place. There was still no true reconciliation physically. David kept his distance because he knew that was the wise path. Saul's repentance did not convince David to return to Gibeah. He knew better. All right, next time we'll continue the story of David in chapter 27 with David's alliance with the Philistines. How does that happen and why? We'll go into all of that in the next installment.
The Church of God the Eternal has just presented the 27th message in a series by Mr. John Brisby, entitled A Survey of the Books of Samuel, given in Eugene, Oregon, May 9th, 2026.